Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
The publishing world is gathered with bated breath. The booksellers are poised over their order forms. The bookies are hoping against hope that an outsider might sneak in. And we can let them all off the hook. The winner of this year's Booker Prize is Hilary Mantel. I'm Claire Armistead, and with me in the studio to weigh it all up are Sarah Crown, editor of the Guardian Books website,
Hi.
And John Crace, who has spent the last couple of weeks digesting the shortlist for the delectation of G2 readers.
Hi.
Welcome both. What do you think of this result?
I'm absolutely delighted. Really, really pleased. I've been backing Hilary from the off. I think it's just one of the most wonderful, exciting, interesting and innovative books that's come out in years, I think, really. And I couldn't have picked a better winner. And so congratulations to the panel. I'm really, really pleased.
John, what do you think? You're probably more salty, are you?
slightly. I mean, it is a good book, but I don't think it's the best one on the shortlist. My thoughts would have been with A.S. Byatt. I know it's a more traditional book and it's got its problems, but I think there is actually a better story and a better structure in there.
Before we go any further, let's have a little bit of Hilary reading from Wolf Hall earlier this year, the Books podcast. This is the introduction to the main character of Wolf Hall, who is Thomas Cromwell, who is the right-hand man to Henry VIII.
And this is Putney, where Cromwell was born in the year, and we're in the year 1500, and he's about 15 years old. And the other player in the scene is his father, a blacksmith. So now get up. Felled, dazed, silent. He's fallen, knocked full length on the cobbles of the yard. His head turned sideways. His eyes are turned towards the gate, as if someone might arrive to help him out. One blow, properly placed, could kill him now. Blood from the gash on his head, which was his father's first effort, is trickling across his face. Add to this, his left eye is blinded. But if he squints sideways with his right eye, he can see that the stitching of his father's boot is unravelling. The twine has sprung clear of the leather, and a hard knot in it has caught his eyebrow and opened another cut. So now get up. Walter is roaring down at him, working out where to kick him next. He lifts his head an inch or two and moves forward on his belly, trying to do it without exposing his hands, on which Walter enjoys stamping. What are you, an eel? His parent asks. He trots backwards, gathers pace, and aims another kick. It knocks the last breath out of him. He thinks it may be his last. His forehead returns to the ground. He lies waiting for Walter to jump on him. The dog Bella is barking, shut away in an outhouse. I'll miss my dog, he thinks. The yard smells of beer and blood. Someone is shouting down on the river bank. Nothing hurts, or perhaps it's that everything hurts because there's no separate pain that he can pick out. But the cold strikes him, just in one place, just through his cheekbone as it rests on the cobbles. Look now, Walter bellows. He hops on one foot as if he's dancing. Look what I've done. Burst my boot, kicking your head. Inch by inch forwards. Never mind if he calls you an eel or a worm or a snake. Head down. Don't provoke him. His nose is clotted with blood and he has to open his mouth to breathe. His father's momentary distraction at the loss of his good boot allows him the leisure to vomit. That's right, Walter yells. Spew everywhere. Spew everywhere on my good cobbles. Come on, boy, get up. Let's see you get up. By the blood of creeping Christ, stand on your feet. Creeping Christ, he thinks. What a way to put it. His head turns sideways. His hair rests in his own vomit. The dog barks. Walter roars. And bells peal out across the water. He feels a sensation of movement, as if the filthy ground has become the Thames. It gives and sways beneath him. He lets out his breath, one great final gasp. "You've done it this time," a voice tells Walter. But he closes his ears, or God closes them for him. He is pulled downstream on a thick black tide.
Do we think it's all right to give this prize to historical novel? There's been quite a lot of fuss about that, hasn't there, this year?
Well, that's been the big question that everyone's raised over the shortlist, this idea of the novels being generally historical. And I've spoken to a couple of the authors on the shortlist about it, and they've come back with quite different views. Hilary Mantel said herself when we did an interview that she didn't really see the book in those terms. And, you know, there was the traditional idea of historical fiction, which was the Jean Pleiades and the Anya Seatons, and what she was doing was sort of slightly outside of that. And Simon Moore, who came from fairly far back in the odds to be the second favourite by the time the prize was actually announced, his book was also supposed to be historical fiction, but actually it was set during World War II. So he said, you know, this is his parents' generation and you can't really kind of be grouping those books together. I think if the story's good enough, why should there be any problem with setting something in the past? I don't think it detracts from the quality of the book at all. So no, I've no problem with it.
John, do we really need more stuff about the Tudors? I mean, they go on and on, don't they?
That is rather my view. And I did feel that with Wolfe Hall, that there was a slight problem. I mean, she creates a wonderful universe of Thomas Cromwell.
Who was Thomas Cromwell?
He was the sort of architect behind King Henry's divorce from Catherine of Aragon and sort of enabled him to... He was a fixer. He was Henry VIII's fixer, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, from my point of view, the book slightly ran out of legs towards the end. You get a wonderful universe, but you kind of felt that a lot of the action was taking place somewhere else between Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII, Catherine of Aragon.
Well, Wolfe Hall is actually isn't visited during the book, is it? He's just off to Wolfe Hall at the end of it.
Yes, I know. That's one of the sort of things you find at the end, that at 650 pages, you're only a third of the way through because there's two volumes to come. And it is a kind of thought of, right, well, I'm not sure if I'm up for the whole ride or not.
But I think this is why I found it so much more than just a historical novel, because it's not just a retelling of the Tudor history that we all know, that we all learn when we were sort of 9 or 10. It's about being inside the mind of this one man, and a man who is cast in all the histories as a total villain, but Mantel manages to make him, if not sympathetic, then at least empathetic, and we can absolutely understand why he made every decision. It's all very incremental, and you know, he moves up and up and up, and you follow him and you believe him and you believe in him. And that's why I think the whole label of a Tudor novel, a historical novel, is it's too meagre for it, I think. It there's so much more going on in this book, and that's, you know, why I think it was such a worthy winner.
There's also it's very visceral, isn't it? You're really down and dirty. You're in the gutters. You smell it. You taste these ghastly things that they're eating. John, how balanced is her universe?
I know it's a revisionist take on Cromwell, but I think it's also a revisionist take on Thomas More, who's always been...
Yeah, absolutely.
And she portrays him in... I mean, she does him a complete disservice, I think.
Thomas More?
Yeah. And in the same way that she creates a kind of depth of character around Thomas Cromwell that's been missing, with Thomas More, she just portrays him as a kind of bullying sort of half-wit, really.
Are you a bit of a hero worshipper of Thomas More?
No, not really. But I think that, you know, there's a bit of even-handedness needed, you know, if you're going to create this kind of...
But don't you think that we've got St. Thomas More, who's only ever portrayed as saintly and wonderful and, you know, utopian and all of the rest of it, and villainous Thomas Cromwell, and all she's done is redress the balance. And it's not as if this one book is going to completely rewrite it.
No, I mean, I kind of agree with that, but... In terms of the rounded universe, I think the universe is not quite as rounded as you would have us believe.
She certainly does look into one of the famous Holbein sketches of Thomas More in his happy family and completely tears it to shreds,
doesn't
she?
Yeah, I mean, it's astonishing. And, I mean, I feel that the book towards the end... in the last sort of 150 pages towards the sort of Thomas More's execution, which is where it kind of finishes up, there is a kind of lengthy bit where you're kind of enjoying the detail, but you're not actually going anywhere very interesting at that time. You have his world, you have his picture. He doesn't develop particularly. And you're waiting for the next bit of the action to move on in terms of, you know, the execution of Anne Boleyn, et cetera, et cetera. But it just doesn't happen. And you kind of get used to the feeling of being left in the air at the end,
I think. Well, we are left in the air because we've got another whole volume to come.
Two, I think.
Thank goodness, from the book, from Sarah and my point of view. So what about the book trade? Are they going to be very happy about this?
I would have thought so. I mean, it's a book. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. I think it's a good book, and it's a book I'd happily recommend for people for Christmas. I mean, unlike some of the usual unreadable Booker winners, this is a book that people can just sort of curl up with and read and enjoy. And I mean, it's all I'm saying is that I think it's got a few flaws, and I'd rather the AS buy it. But it's certainly a worthy winner compared to lots of others in the past.
Will it be a bestseller for Christmas, do you think, Sarah?
I hope so. I think she deserves it. She's someone who has always had huge critical respect and very small sales. And I think this is the book that will start to generate her a bit of income, which would be nice.
I would certainly second that. So now, are the bookies going to get a terrible shock? Are they all going to go broke overnight because of this result? We've heard how desperate they are that the favourite didn't win. It's the most popular favourite ever, isn't it?
Yeah, and favourites have a habit of not winning.
They've never won before, I think.
It was 98, I think, was the last one. I think I read that today, although I may be wrong. But I think it was 98, was the favourite, and he won. And that was the last one. So that's ages ago.
Is it going to be bad news for them, or is actually the money so small it's all a bit of performance art?
I mean, I guess, you know, it's different from the favourite of the Grand National winning, presumably. I imagine that fewer people have bothered to get involved and put a bet on. I told my family to bet on Hilary Mantel back months ago, and did any of them bother? No, they did not. So I think that probably says all we need to know about how many people have bet on the book.
Well, that's it for our Booker podcast. You can listen to John Crace's Digested Wolf Hall and my interview for the Book of the Week podcast with Hilary Mantel from earlier this year on guardian.co.uk/books. And look out for a video interview with Hilary that our very own Sarah has recorded for the site too. That's it for now. We'll be back on Friday with an interview with Michael Palin. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Scott Corley. Goodbye.